House Committee on Healthcare to order for the last time, I think, during this session, unless we keep going on to July and August or something, we might find ways to meet again. But assuming not, this will be the last session. And I'll open an informational meeting on the Central Oregon Health Council legislative report to us and turn the floor over to Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for making time to hear about one of my favorite subjects. And certainly, I think, a success story in the state's efforts to transform Medicaid delivery. The Central Oregon Health Council is a is an interesting evolution. I'm sure you'll hear a little bit more about it. But it is kind of a unique situation in primarily three counties, Jefferson, Crook, and Deschutes. And the Central Oregon Health Council has become the governing body of that region of the CCO, the Coordinated Care Organization, which also extends up into Hood River and Wasco counties. So the Central Oregon Health Council provides governance for the CCO, primarily, again, for the three Central Oregon counties, Jefferson, Crook, and Deschutes. And with us today, you have some of, again, my favorite people and folks who are very, very knowledgeable about the evolution of this effort in Central Oregon and what has happened before and since our healthcare transformation in 2012. And I guess, may I introduce them and then they can come up and begin their testimony. Is Zach coming up too? No?
I tried to talk him into it, but frankly, he's a little nervous.
Well,
he's never.
Well, he should be. Wait till he sees how we abuse you.
I know. Wait till he sees the questions you're going to get. So I'll introduce the two speakers, but also mention that Zach Pangaris is staff for the Central Oregon Health Council. And although he's backbenching today, he does a really fantastic job and is integral in the efforts of the Health Council. Also integral to the efforts of the Health Council is Dr. Robin Henderson, who is with St. Charles and is the current executive director of the Central Oregon Health Council. And with her is Commissioner Tammy Bainey, who is the chair of the Central Oregon Health Council and is a Deschutes County Commissioner, along with a whole long list of other accomplishments and service to the state that is really we benefit from. Yes, absolutely. Deserve a lot of credit. Should I go on?
No, we're good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Don't want to start you off embarrassed or anything.
Okay.
All right. Well, and what the good representative, Chair Greenlich, my apologies here, Chair Greenlich, as Representative Conger said, I'm Robin Henderson for the record, and I'm the Executive Director of the Central Oregon Health Council.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for making time. This has been an incredible journey. We started over 3 years ago before there was even a coordinated care organization. Mm-hmm. We were a regional health authority. We were an ACO for a short period of time and then landed on a CCO, and all the while trying to make sure that we were doing what was best for those that we were trying to provide service to in our region. So with that, shall we kick off?
Yes.
You want to say? Oh, I'm sorry. Right. I'm Tammy Bainey, Deschutes County Commissioner and also Chair of the Health Council. I've done this before, but I'm slow today. Thank you.
Well, we really wanted the opportunity to update you on what we learned. We saw a lot of the legislation come through this year. Some of that legislation, I think, could be informed by what we've learned, and I think there's a lot of benefits to what we've learned. And I'm watching the room get dark. It's so peaceful. I'm waiting for
the lights up, please.
Come out. But really what we wanted to do was update you on the implementation, as we're required to do by the law that surrounds us, and talk a little bit about how our initial implementation of our regional health improvement plan has been, show you a little bit about what that looks like. We want to talk about the structure of the governance and what entities are involved and what works and what doesn't work. And as you probably know from prior testimony of mine, I tend to be a little frank, and so the commissioner and I have agreed that warts and all, we're going to tell you what works and what really doesn't work. And please chime in as you see fit, because I think it's very informative as we move this forward. We want to talk about our current initiatives, our early successes, what we're doing going forward, and then really have more of a dialogue around what we see as the future of community governance. Our model has been based in a public-private partnership all along. We've functioned from a model of community governance, and we think that that holds great promise for CCOs going forward. And we've spent a lot of time talking with a variety of CCOs about our community governance model, and there's interest in looking at that further. Just to ground back in where we came from, we started back in 2011 with this dream that we could transform healthcare in Central Oregon and develop these three principles of care coordination, health policy and planning, and really resource integration and conservation that would lead us to get to the triple aim: better health, better care, better value for our healthcare dollars. With the goal that we would reinvest the dollars that we saved back into our community. That's grounded us in everything we've done since we started. And it really has been kind of the theme that when things start to go a little bit off course, we come back to why are we here? And it's these three sets of principles that we've grounded ourselves in.
If I may, I think one thing that's also important in this particular slide is that, as you'll note, the Transforming Health in Central Oregon, we've made sure that we are not just talking about medical payment reform and that we're actually talking about transformation of the health of our community and looking at it in a more broad sense than just medical payment reform. And that'll come up in the future here.
Hey, can we infer that you're a nonprofit organization?
Yes, we are. We're separate in the process of applying for a 501c3, but the Central Oregon Health Council is a separate nonprofit. It's funded right now by a portion of the per member per month allotment that comes out of the allotment that Pacific Source gets as the CCO, and that's defined in our joint management agreement, which we're going to talk about a little bit more, but that's how we're funded. This just gives you a basic overview of our structure. It's different than what you would normally see for a CCO. The three councils that are the primary councils, the Community Advisory Council, the Clinical Advisory Panel, and the Operations Council, report directly to the Health Council, and they don't report to the CCO. So what happens in, for instance, with our Community Advisory Council, they report to the CCO through the Health Council, and the Health Council is the governing body, is the one that charters and really sets those things up. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Operations Council. That's something that's unique to our region and what we feel is extraordinarily essential to what we do.
And then also we'll talk about how the Clinical Advisory Panel and the Community Advisory Panel or Council feeds in as well. But I would say that this structure is one that we are working with. Mm-hmm. It is one that we are going to be adjusting now that we've had a little bit more time under our belt to make sure that the committee structure supports the work that we need to be doing as well. So the Health Council. As you will see.
Can I?
Yes.
Oh, please. Yes. Listen, we have plenty of time.
Oh, please.
So if you just interrupt without anytime you feel like it. What does COHC mean?
The Central Oregon Health Council.
Okay. That's the name of the overall body.
Correct.
Okay.
And again, Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson.
I should know that. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Please just go.
A question, please.
Yeah, no, just... Yeah. Just
I guess I also wanted to know, at this point, how many people are enrolled in the program?
Just under 30,000.
Okay. And the population base for the area is?
Just about 200.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman,
are these all Medicaid?
Yes.
Okay.
If I may, one thing I think is unique, as we're talking about a region, Crook and Jefferson are very small, Deschutes being not quite so small. So just in that, coming to the table has been a feat. And then as you look at the composition of our health council, you will see that unlike some CCOs, we have, and this maybe goes into the operations council discussion, but what we have here are essentially the, we used to call them the heads of the families. It was almost like the old school mafia, but you have your CEO of the healthcare system. You have a commissioner versus maybe a public health director or a mental health director for your of your county. So we have a commissioner from Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County. We have Dan Stevens, who represents Pacific Source. We have Dr. Mark Williams, who's a psychiatrist. We have Mike Shercliffe, who's with Advantage Dental. We have Dr. Mann, who is the president of our IPA, our Independent Practice Association. Linda McCoy is our community member extraordinaire. She also chairs the Community Advisory Council. We have Greg Hagfors, who is the CEO of Ben Memorial Clinic, which is one of our large IPAs as well. Megan Hayes, who is the CEO of Mosaic, which is our federally qualified healthcare center. And then Chuck Frazier, who is also a community member. He is a retired pharmacist and very sharp with a pencil. And then it's myself. But as you see here, and what you will see also with the Ops Council, is that this board needs to be able to make decisions and not spend a lot of time going back to where to their boards to be able to bring forward decision-making abilities. And so this... it's a lot of personalities, and there's a fair amount of politics on this board, but I think the composition is one that we have everyone at the table in order to be able to get this work done.
So
how did this board get appointed? Who appointed this board?
Part of it was statutory in what we built into Senate Bill 204, but it really started out of what we call the transitional board back in 2011.
Wait, Trump's not lively about 204?
Yeah.
Senate Bill 204 was before the CCO.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Yeah, we, in 2011, there was a budget note that Senator Bates and Representative Kotek put on the DHS budget to start looking at, actually it was 2009, sorry, 2009. Yeah. That budget note was to start looking at how you could combine the spend, particularly mental health and physical health, and looking at pilot projects that would do that. Mm. We convened a transitional board made up of our three county commissioners, Jim Deagle, who's the head of St. Charles Health System, the big health system, what at that time, Ken Preventer, who is the head of Pacific Source Health Plans, Megan Hayes, who at that time was the president of the IPA, she's now the CEO of Mosaic Medical, Bruce Goldberg from the Health Authority, and those seven people were that transitional board that from 2009 until the legislation that set up, you know, Senate Bill 204 in 2011, those seven people governed what we did in that demonstration project for OHA.
And that was going alongside the CCO development, but viewed by everybody as the sort of prototype. It was a prototype for the CCO.
Thank you.
So our legislation defined this out. One of the interesting things is if you go back, and I said this in my testimony in House Bill 3309 last week, some of these players 3 years ago wouldn't even speak to each other in the same room and fought on the front pages of the papers in Bend. And it just was a very tumultuous time in Central Oregon between the different health system partners.
I think we're all shocked that there's rivalries in politics in the healthcare community.
I mean, it isn't as if there's any money involved.
No.
None. This health council and the process of this health council, and these are the original members who were appointed shortly after Senate Bill 204 took effect, helped to resolve those issues over time and make it a much more workable.
I think it's also important to note that typically you would not have dental. That would be a part of your maybe governance structure. And it was an interesting conversation when that occurred. It was, are you going to be at risk? And this is one member to another. One is statutorily at risk, and the other is more voluntarily at risk. Yet the voluntarily at risk person wanted to be a voting member. And we essentially had the, will you put your money on the table? And if not, then no. And if so, then yes. And that conversation was, you could hear a pin drop. Mm-hmm. But as you can see, we have those two individuals, and it's working out. So.
I think the amazing thing was getting your three county commissioners involved. because that's real politics.
It is real politics. Yes, it is. But it's also the public health, behavioral health, land use, transportation. I mean, there are just so many reasons why we need to be there. And it'll in future slides as well, it'll be pointed out. So governance. We have Just as I mentioned, 9 of our 12 members are risk-bearing, and we have the contract arrangements. We have a joint management agreement, which is 26 pages of how we will play well, and if we are not playing well, how we will disagree. And thank you to our representative as well as our attorney who's been able to guide us through that process. It has been more than once that we have reflected back on those 26 pages of guidelines that have really helped us. Our meetings, essentially, we operate essentially off a public meetings law. We have had a lot of challenges to that. In particular, should people be able to, what if I want to approach the board, or what if I have a question, or how do I get appointed, or how do I get on a committee? When will you be talking about the contracts? When will we, all of those conversations, and we just take them one by one. We have had a couple of times where we've gone into executive session, primarily around personnel issues, same as you would with any other public meeting. But we do our very best, and I would say that we operate at about 90% of what would be true to your public meetings laws, as you would know. Some find this bumpy and new. Three of the members being county commissioners, it's just our way of doing business. So you have a large sector on that board that really would not operate otherwise. So I think it's worked out. I think it's worked out well. Materials are posted on the website, always open to testimony. Matter of fact, at many of our meetings, we'll just take questions from the audience and try and filter that into the conversation. Open to the press, of course, and we treat them, we poke at them a little bit just because they're trying to learn something very new as well. What is this big CCO conversation about? We want to make sure that the information that's conveyed is correct in turn. And all voting members are equal. One recent example of this is the woman, Linda McCoy, who is amazing, who chairs our community advisory council, and she was struggling. It's like herding cats on occasion. She's trying to keep everybody moving in the appropriate direction, and the governing body had not given clear direction on what the role and function of the community advisory council was really to be working on. And hello, Representative. And so it was. She was kind of just struggling with her place. And as a community member, she's a mom. She's a foster mom. I think she walks on water. She's absolutely amazing. And she was self-doubt. The CEO of the hospital system, who runs all the hospitals in all three counties, looked to her and said, "Do you recognize that you have the exact same vote that I do?" And all of a sudden, she wasn't puffing up, but she definitely sat up a little bit straighter and just kind of looked at him and thought, here's an individual with a $1 billion organization, and I'm a mother who is taking care of children and running an advisory council, and we have the exact same vote. I get it. And so from that moment, I think that will tell you about the accountability and the governance and how we truly understand the essence of the work that we're doing.
This kind of lays out takes the 26 pages and boils them down a little bit better into something that's a little bit easier to read. And it shows you what Pacific Source is responsible for and what the Health Council is responsible for. Pacific Source is the legal entity. They have the contract. They hold the contract with OHA. And that has good and difficulties with it. We're going to talk a little bit more about what some of those things are. They do all of the managed care. They do all of the third-party administrator functions. They ensure the work plan goes on. They bear the risk. Now, as part of our joint management agreement, however, if we're in a situation where we have a $100 million spend, let's say, it's more than that, but 100 is a number I can work with. You have the 8% that goes to the administrative functions, and then you have basically the rest of the dollars. So if we spend more in a given year by joint management agreement, in a year where we may spend less and have money to share, that money has to go back to Pacific Source first at about 50% of what we owe them, at 50% of what we owe them to pay back that reserve. So their shared risk reserve, and Jason, Representative Coninger explains this far better than I do, but there's a share in the risk reserve, but they are the risk-bearing entity for the CCO. They're also the contracts
person. The hospital's not at risk?
The hospital's at risk through contract.
With Pacific Source?
With Pacific Source. And that's part of the dance that we're in right now, is how do we move more and more and more of the risk to the contract bearers. so that the hospital goes at risk for XYZ population. The IPA goes at risk. They do have a small risk-bearing agreement that makes them a risk-bearing entity. The hospital also has some risk, but they're looking to expand how those risk contracts go. And that's kind of the dance that we're in the first 2 years of being a CCO, is shifting those contracts so more and more of the risk goes down to the provider level. But for the legal definition of risk that it took to set up a CCO, that legal definition is met by Pacific Source.
Including the reserve requirements so that the state is protected when we turn the money over. Pacific Source, being a larger insurer, has the reserves for the global budget for the Central Oregon region for their CCO. One of the effects of that is that in Central Oregon there wasn't a need to go around and raise the capital for the reserves because it already existed. Pacific Source was the managed care organization previously for the region, and so I think it was it was a challenge for Pacific Source and for the Central Oregon Health Council to figure out how that should work, but ultimately it was very, very smooth during the formation phase. And part of the result, and this is a real credit to everyone around the table, Pacific Source certainly included, but St. Charles and the other providers who are at risk in this whole process financially, that they were willing to go into a room where they only had one vote. So that's a major statement. The discussion about Linda was really important because she, of course, is not at risk, but she is one of 12 equal votes on that board, and that creates an environment where there is no entity that controls the board meetings or can exert an overwhelming amount of influence over the outcome. It has to be by persuasion.
It's interesting that the risk relationship comes between Pacific Source and other risk bearers, not between COHC and other risk bearers.
COHC is only a governing entity, so it's a nonprofit with no capitalization, a very, very small budget, and its function is to provide. We'll talk more about the functions here, and this slide describes them a little bit, but it is really ultimately governance and interaction with the community. Governance from a broad perspective, as we tried to embody in 1580 when we passed the final version of healthcare transformation. In other words, having a governing body that is not Pacific Source's board, but is a board comprised of providers meeting that statutory requirement, who are at risk in most cases, and as well as community members, although they chose to go above and beyond that and have two community members, and then also primary care, mental health, and physical health represented, et cetera, on down the line.
It's interesting to note, I know in some CCOs, when you had the buy-in for the share, that bought the importance of your vote. These were the things that we avoided in the way we set this up and made it more of that community governance model where even if we're talking about the budget, everybody's in the room. If we're talking about things that matter clinically, everybody's in the room, everybody's all there. And that's very different than what I've seen in other CCO governance models. It's a very unique way to do it.
Their individual contracts, though, would be more spoken to as far as principles, not the actual contract. We do have some sensitivity, so that not everybody's sharing all of their materials, but it would be more in principles of the guiding principles of how their contracts are set versus the actual specific details.
Right. One of the benefits of this structure is that you actually have Pacific Source, in a sense, being a third party in the meaning that Pacific Source is not a healthcare provider who is competing with the hospital or with the FQHC or with Ben Memorial Clinic, which is a large specialty and primary care clinic. So they're not competitors, so they're not sharing members of this board don't see each other's contract terms, which avoids some moral hazard, I think, or potential moral hazard, and also make sure that there's no antitrust concerns, such as there could be, I think, if they were approving each other's contracts, or at least were informed about their reimbursement rates.
One last thing on this slide that I think is important, and I, as a county commissioner, I am about this deep in knowledge. I am not as steeped as much as Ms. Henderson may be, or those that are maybe running a hospital or an IPA, but I think the bullet point that talks about the dispute resolution among the stakeholders, I do know that that has been an issue that the state has been struggling with because everyone has the exact same vote, and we do not have a majority of one, meaning the hospital does not have a majority vote. We do not have an IPA that has a majority vote. The commissioners do not have a majority vote. We all figure, yes, we all figure it out. And so I think that has been a sweet spot for us to get around some of the issues that others may be struggling with.
We're not perfect, and so part of what we did was to highlight in a little different color there, those are some of the challenges we're dealing with. The things that are in black, when you look at the Health Council, we've done really well. Transparency and accountability, those types of things. We've done these things well. The things that are highlighted more in a red color are the things that we need to work on in the next year, and they're the things that we're kind of struggling with right now in terms of making sure that we have a global budget framework, that we're more active in setting our performance metrics and things like that. And we're going to talk a little bit more about our challenges in this slide, Commissioner.
Yes. So our primary focus, trying to lead this group of strong personalities and very vested folks, I needed to make sure that they had buy-in toward where we were headed. And so we spent a lot of time in details that maybe we should have been a little bit more in governance. Bless you. But so what we were able to do is work through some initiatives where there will be follow-up slides that will make more sense here in just a moment. But we really were a little more in the details, as I mentioned, and now we need to really strive toward more of that governance piece. Communication has been challenging. Even internally for us, a lot of communications from the state will come to our CCO. And for everyone else in the state of Oregon, their CCO is essentially they're talking to people like us. Right. For our CCO, they are contacting Pacific Source, which is our contractor, but our CCO governance structure is to contract and contact us. And so it's this, because it's set up differently, there's been a little bit of what I would call a hitch in the giddy-up with the communication with the state of Oregon. Not anything that we can't change, but again, that communication has led to a little bit of some confusing times.
For those of you who aren't from Central Oregon, hitch and giddy-up means that there's been some obstacles.
Yes.
I actually learned that in Detroit.
Good.
I like horse tripping.
Yes. Well, we won't have any of that, Mr. Chairman, but on occasion we do have a wee bit of a hitch in the giddy-up. So the role of our governance is the direction for us now, is making sure that we are staying where we need to stay as a governance structure. And the three components there would be the transformation, shared savings, and the global budget, but really keeping us guided toward that transformation of health and the health of our community, and not so much the details of what our contractor needs to be providing. But again, the challenge is communication. I cannot tell you how important the communication link between the state is and making sure that we all are operating off that same platform.
I want to tell you a little bit about one of the unique things and the characteristics that we have, and that's our Operations Council. Back in 2009, when we went after the budget note, it wasn't, much as I love my commissioners, it wasn't the commissioners who went, oh, wow, look, a budget note. We could do something cool. No. It was the folks who were down there in the trenches who knew that we had a problem in our ER when folks came into our ER who had a mental health condition, that the folks in the mental health clinic had no way of knowing because there was no coding that was going to tell them that. And we were running in two separate systems, and it was a mess. And it was the operational folks, the mental health directors, the public health directors. At that time, I was director of behavioral health at the hospital. I knew intimately what this problem was. And the people who were over at the multi-specialty clinics going, my patients are coming in here, and yet I don't know they're in the ER. So we started in 2009 to bring together all of those directors, and we formalized it then in 2011 when we set up the outcome of Senate Bill 204, what now is called our Operations Council. These are not clinicians. These are operational administrators, clinic directors, people who can make an independent decision about their clinic and implement it, people who are knowledgeable about how things function in a clinic setting as opposed to how things function clinically, which are two different things. And that strength has brought us the ability to bring initiatives up pretty fast. It's our job to implement the operational plans. We're the ones in charge of making sure that the regional health improvement plan gets done. We're the ones who are in charge of making sure the strategic initiatives roll out. We're in charge of the quality incentive metrics. We're the ones who are going to figure that out. And the coordination between agencies has really increased our collaboration and decreased our duplication of effort. It's amazing when you start getting folks in a room together and they're talking. And one of the remarkable conversations I remember, we were talking about an initiative looking at increasing pediatric care coordination in our pediatric clinic, which is a private clinic. The largest pediatric clinic that sees the most Medicaid patients isn't an FQHC in our region. It's a private clinic. And the folks from public health were getting very agitated and going, I've got a strong relationship with them. I know I do. And it was very passionate about feeling that they were being picked on for maybe they weren't providing enough care. And from across the room, the clinic administrator raises his hand and says, hi, I'm Wade Miller. I'm the clinic manager of Central Oregon Pediatrics. Who are you?
Yeah.
And it just was kind of that escalation of, wow, at an administrator level, we didn't know each other. And this has changed. And what came out of that was the clinic administrator from the largest obstetrics clinic developed a great relationship with these public health directors to really push out the nurse-family partnership very differently, very, very differently. And those types of relationships have been essential to helping us move things forward very, very quickly. We have more than 50 individuals involved in our regional work groups around the community. It's been a very powerful tool for us. They meet twice a month, and I'd highly recommend them to other CCOs. We also have our Community Advisory Council. You're familiar with the functions of that. We have folks, primarily the majority is consumers, folks who either are currently or are guardians of or have been within the last 2 years members of the Oregon Health Plan. Our chair is a community member. We didn't go for a chair that was something different than that. And they have other representatives. And I want to share with you what she's presented at her last health council meeting. This is her structure that she worked out with her community advisory council on how they're going to manage their book of work. They see their aim to identify and make recommendations about how we meet the consumer and community health needs, including the vulnerable and underserved children, adults, and families. And their focus areas line up to the transformation plan elements that they're required to support. So for us, that's element number 4, which is the community health assessment and the community health improvement plan. Focus number 6 around outreach and engagement. Focus number 7 around cultural competence. And focus number 8 around health disparities.
Robin, I noticed Warm Springs is one of the communities. Do you have a relationship with the Indian Health Programs? Or?
We do. It's been more in the community advisory council level than anywhere else. It's getting stronger. And there have been a lot of very positive conversations out of that.
But you don't link with the formal program. I mean, you're not the whatever the Native American health arrangement is
mm-hmm.
on the reservation doesn't feed into the CCO, is that?
Not at this point. That may change at some point, but not at this point. It's been more around the area of technical assistance for us, both ways. It's kind of a two-way street.
one of the members, though, of our community. Well, I don't know that Heather is a member, but she is essentially a mentor, someone who's offers assistance, and she's a tribal member, and she also works for Best Care Treatment, and she's with, they do the alcohol and drug treatment in the Jefferson County area, but she's been really, she's a member of Warm Springs, and so it also helps to bridge some of the cultural differences in how we're approaching things. It's been great to have her involvement. And this also, our innovator agent, although I will tell you I was a little, I wanted the dollar spent differently, shall we say. I wasn't sure of the value added of an innovator agent into our community, and she's been delightful to work with and really helpful for our community advisory council as well. So she was very helpful with Linda putting this together. I just wanted to put in that plug. Mm-hmm. Clinical advisory panel. This has been an interesting one. We have many alternative medicine folks that are struggling to find their place at the table. Whether I am at a grocery store, ballpark, car wash, I will be approached by individuals saying, oh, I'm a massage therapist, or I do acupuncture, or where do I fit into this whole CCO network? Our clinical advisory panel is primarily put together. Originally, we had a lot of providers. But we had a lot of primary care providers that were involved, and we had some behavioral health, but I would say that it ended up mainly being physicians that were involved. Mm-hmm. I would not say that that was bad, but it was one side of a very broad conversation. And so we needed to make sure that we had the appropriate composition at that panel, representing all that have a voice in transformation. We have not been able to find that voice yet, and I think that's important to note. So we had a very open, very transparent conversation with the leadership of that group and said, our health council is struggling with the value added and the role for this committee. The committee themselves said to me, we are struggling with our own value to add and our own role in the transformation. So what we've done is we have gone ahead and we're going to take a summer hiatus, and we're going to get clear on the role and function of our health council governance, what we need to support the work, how our physicians and how our specialty care and et cetera and alternative care fit into that, and then restructure a clinical advisory panel that will meet those needs. Something that's more broad. We also did not have a link that was a member of our governance board that was chairing that work. Mm-hmm. And so we learned that lesson as well, that we really needed to have that voice back direct to the board and direct from the board to the clinical advisory panel to be able to have continuity. But it was...
As soon as you start dealing with outcome matrix, the outcome metrics that OHA is giving you, that board would be a very important place to be commenting on how you're doing on those metrics.
Absolutely. And Chair Greenlick, that has been, what we do have are people that are very interested in being engaged now. And so we do have some that are part of each one of our elements that will have a provider who is, maybe they specialize in early childhood and pediatrics. So they can be linked to an initiative to make sure that that's carried forward. What we're struggling with is the role of the community as a whole that are providing that care and making sure that everyone, not everyone, but making sure that they have a voice. The difficulty from a provider's standpoint is, especially let's take behavioral health. If I'm a mental health provider, there are a number of mental health providers, but not one voice. If you are an independent physician, you have an organization. So our community is actually working together to coordinate themselves to come to do a mental health IPA. And so they will then have one voice. They can actually have a representative and be able to be at the table. But if you are other specialty alternative care, it's difficult to have, mm-hmm. when you have 50 to 75 massage therapists, it's very difficult for each one to have a voice, or acupuncture or whatnot.
Or whatever. Well, and with the quality incentive metrics, I take something like adolescent well care visits has been my favorite one to pick on right now.
we can have all the pediatricians in the world sit around and talk about how do we increase adolescent well care visits. But the bottom line is there's a clinic function issue that has to happen in there. The clinic has to change their functioning for how they're reminding parents that it's time for your adolescent well care visit. And then we have to figure out how do we capture that. A clinician's not going to want to participate in that. They're not going to be the functional person to sit down and go, this is how we make the phone call, and this is how we're going to do this protocol. For some of the quality incentive metrics, I think there's very much provider input that needs to happen in there. But for many of them, and I'll show you how we've done those out, a lot of times it's changing clinic practice and changing coding. And that's something that providers don't have, I think, the bandwidth to understand in the limited time that we get them.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you. I mean, for example, I could imagine sitting around in a group of all kinds of providers and saying, we're not meeting this metric on adolescent well visit, whatever it's called. And some people can say, well, the problem is we're not calling the parents. Other people can say the problem is, well, we don't really have the clinic time. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can do something by adding a nurse practitioner that would focus specifically on it. I mean, it seemed to me their perspective, once they all got into the notion that how are we going to solve this problem we have, it seems to me could be very valuable.
I would definitely agree with that.
I think the point is you need both. And
the point is you what?
You need both. You need need the practitioner perspective as well as sometimes, not always, but often you need the administrative perspective.
Absolutely.
About how do you implement it. And it's really interesting to me to watch this evolve as, you know, and Central Oregon did two things that not every CCO has done. They created a specific operations council, which was, I think, kind of a mix of both practitioners and administrators. And then they had the clinical advisory panel. And the question is, you know, as it's going along, how are the two organizations, how are the two sub-organizations of the Central Oregon Health Council, what are their roles? What can they bring to the table, and what do they need to be doing?
I just have to say a quick thing, because I have to go testify right now in the Budget Committee for Human Services on the Traditional Healthcare Workers Commission.
Oh.
So the whole conversation about who's going to make that call and what kind of workforce are we going to have.
Right.
Hopefully, I'm going to address that right now.
We'll get that done.
Hopefully, I'll be back to hear that.
Speak loud, and we
can
hear you.
Yeah, that's right.
If I may just tag on to that. Since we have the Ops Council, those are the folks that are actually running the clinics primarily. But then we also, on the governance structure, you would have, let's take the hospital for instance. Robin has behavioral health. I'm just throwing out a hypothetical example. If we need to change something in the delivery of behavioral health and we need to integrate or do something through the hospital system in that particular arena, you have your CEO of the hospital who is saying, go forward and do this. And then you have the buy-in from the Ops Council saying, well, here's how we can do it, and here's what it would look like. Because the only way we can sit around and spend time in a governance structure trying to talk about transformation, but if we don't trickle that down into our organizations and truly change how we're doing business, we're really just sitting around a room talking about how we're going to transform something. So it's that trickle down and that embedding those decisions into the everyday work that is that two-pronged between the Ops Council and the governance structure.
So do you have some, I understand you're going through this right now and have this conversation, but do you have some concepts that have come out, again, especially those where there's a lot of providers in no organization, about how you might bridge that?
Well, we have some initiatives and
It's been basically an initiative at a time.
Okay.
It is, we're still kind of that granular. And a great example is elective deliveries before 39 weeks. There's a portion of that that is a clinic practice, a portion of that that's a hospital practice, but it really is figuring out is who is the key obstetrics leader who can go in there and help say, okay, these are the things we need to do to move this mark. And each one of these incentive metrics and strategic initiatives has required that granular analysis to figure out what's the push that you got to push on it to make it change. And it's not the same for everyone.
No.
I hope a year from now we'll have a better answer for you, though.
But I think one thing that is important to note, the emergency room diversion program, that was a pilot project. It's no longer a pilot project. It's just the way that we do business. And so I think that's a good success, which we'll get to in a little bit.
One of the things we did do was we completed our regional health improvement plan. That's been implemented for us. We didn't attach it. It's a living, breathing document that you can find on our website. But I do want to show you, and I think I can do it from here. I think it will allow me to do this. Yes. This is Healthier Central Oregon. And this is our database that allows us at any given time, we can draw into just about anything you want. Today we're looking at, let's look at early prenatal care. This community dashboard is accessible at any time, updated by the Healthy Communities Institute in real time. Some of this data updates weekly, some monthly. It can go down to the zip code level depending on what data element you're looking at. But it's been a great, great, there's the community dashboard, tool for us to really begin to look very quickly. Where are we at on any type of a metric? You know, we need to work on our breast cancer over here. We need to work on breast cancer. It's a big deal for us. But really allows us to look at things from a very different level very quickly. We do have a problem with adult fruit and vegetable consumption in Central Oregon, just so we're clear. But this has been a great tool that is funded by the community. A lot of different partners play in this space. Doesn't cost us, I think it's about $40,000 a year. But it's been a great tool for our regional health improvement plan to be updated in routine time so that we don't have to go back all the time and look at this. And for people who are applying for grants, all your data is right here. It's an absolutely wonderful, highly recommended thing to do, and we're really glad we did that for our community.
And so, data comes from, I'm sorry, John. No, please.
So the Central Oregon Health Council oversees this? I mean, who? That's the body that oversees all of this information?
We do it in partnership with the Health Board, or what is called WEBCO, the Wellness and Education Board of Central Oregon. WEBCO, and you can explain that a little better than I can.
So we, all of our behavioral health dollars fall into a tri-county group. We used to have Accountable Behavioral Health, so we cover all of the Medicaid for the region. And we, through a 190 agreement, became a governing, or a, we're a form of government. And so we can regionalize all of our funds. And it also, one thing that this helped us do, we collect our data across jurisdictional lines because some work in one county and live in another. It also helps us have less planning and plans to write. And over a 10-year period, the three counties were doing 66 different plans. Sure. This allows us to do one coordinated plan, and then each plan has a unique piece for each community. So it still has that community uniqueness, but it reduces duplication, allows us to look at things such as tobacco use and whatever it might be, our breast cancer. Someone who may work in Bend and live in Madras can have their medical visit in Bend. We can capture that, and it just really allows us better access and better service delivery. So it's, and then that information obviously is used for all of our coordinated care transformation work that we're trying to do as well. Mm-hmm. But it factors things in like public health indicators and the social determinants of health and transportation, land use planning, all if we're truly not, if we're not just talking about changing the medical payment, that, and we're talking about transformation of health, then we have to be talking about things that are a bit more broad than just diabetes and how we actually got to that. But if we did have an indicator for craft beer consumption, I think it would actually be fairly to the good. I think it'd be in the green.
It would be near 100%.
Near perfect. I just think it's what we're tracking is.
We are one of the top 10 cities in the United States for beer vana. But this really has been a great tool, and it was one of our first initial efforts connected to our regional health improvement plan. The data comes from a variety of different places. Healthy Communities Institute navigates that and works with the data people at the counties and with the data people at Pacific Source, but they pull it from a variety of well-vetted places. So it's been a great tool for us to have. For us, we won't be doing another regional health improvement plan until 2015. Because Senate Bill 204 gave us the ability to do one plan over a four-year period and then re-update it as we need to. It's a living document that we update all of the time. And one of the challenges that we've had is that even though we have the statute that allows us to have this four-year plan, more than once we have to take our statute and go back to our friends at OHA and say, I get that you'd like to have your report this way, but let me help you understand our statute that says that we're a little different here. And also we have to remind ourselves what we've reported off in the past. Well, you know, yeah, but I need to have this over here. No, we're all singing from the same hymnal.
This is one regional hymnal.
I'd like to explore that. Do you imply, should I infer from that you don't need to follow the regulations of the CCO in terms of reporting regulations and things like that?
No, they're encompassed within there. This is more about the plans that public health, mental health, early learning council, the plans that counties have to do and are responsible for. We rolled those into one tri-county plan. So we follow the CCO regulations with the exception of having to do another regional health improvement plan. We're on a different timeline for that because we got started early.
But, Mr. Chairman, if I may, you can also parse out how Madras is doing mm-hmm. and how Lapine is doing. So it
I'm
can
just
be
trying to find out, if you didn't have 204, how would you be different in terms of responding to the CCO requirements?
We wouldn't. It wrapped in there. We were able to wrap it in there well enough. But in our transformation plan,
reminding them that you're on a different approach. To
it's the difference between what we do as a CCO and what the counties do as counties. Because much of the public health planning and the documents that are required by addictions and mental health aren't necessarily wrapped into the CCO regulations yet.
Mm. We would be doing.
That's a different problem.
It's a different problem. Mm-hmm. We think this is a great solution. Having one regional plan that goes over 4 years has stopped a lot of that planning, you know, planning to plan because somebody 20 years ago thought this was a good idea, so you've got to do your biennial plan and your triennial plan.
We had a statute, we had a bill to try and put that together. I think we passed it. To try and deal with the fact that counties are required to do a mental health plan, a physical health plan.
We did. I don't think it's passed yet, but it will. It's down in, I want to say rules, but
It allows us to look, because a lot of those plans touch one another, but if done independently, you don't get a chance to see where they touch one another. And I think also when you're serving a population versus trying to serve a geographic jurisdictional boundary, we write plans for jurisdictional boundaries, not for the people that we are serving. And I think this allows us to do better planning for those we're serving versus planning for a jurisdictional boundary.
So we do want to share with you a little bit about what's gone well, because we know that you like shiny, sparkly things that finance real change. Whoopsie, let me back this up. Sorry. When we started in 2009, we had three primary initiatives and then one other initiative that came in. We started the program for the evaluation of development and learning. For those of you who know anything about OHSU, that's like the Child Development and Resource Center. And rather than being a direct offshoot of the Child Development and Resource Center, which operates a multidisciplinary assessment clinic for children with special health care needs, we started our own in partnership with them where they send us a developmental pediatrician once a month. This has been extraordinarily successful in allowing kids who have very, very high need, multi-complex problems to receive their multidisciplinary assessments and treatment plans in their own community and then be able to build out those relationships within their own community rather than coming back to Central Oregon with a packet of an assessment going, what is an occupational therapist and how do I find one? We have a waiting list currently of more than a year, which tells us that we need to expand that clinic, and we're in the process of doing that. And having the health council's backing for that is going to allow us to push that forward. We also do what's called the neonatal intensive care unit follow-up clinic. We identify, we've been doing this for about 3.5 years. We took a very targeted set of indicators for high-risk babies born in our neonatal intensive care unit, and we schedule those babies for follow-up at like 9 months, 18 months. At about 18 months, we start to determine, is your next visit 36 months or 24 months, looking for neurodevelopmental problems that are going to come out, cerebral palsy, autism spectrum disorders, learning disabilities, physical challenges, things like that. It's a free screening clinic, and our goal is to do two things. One, to have early identification and assessment of what these children are doing so that we can intervene earlier, but also as important is to study what it is that we did.
so that we can change then the practices that happen in the neonatal intensive care unit to better improve the outcomes that we're getting 3 and 4 years later. It's a very fascinating program. That allowed us to expand our behavioral health consultants, who are psychologists who work in primary care, directly into the neonatal intensive care unit, and we've started to lower the length of stay.
The more intensive your assessment of it is, the worse your outcome is going to be, because you're going to find kids that you would have missed without having that kind of assessment.
Exactly. But if we intervene earlier, we save brain. Mm-hmm. And 15 years from now, these are not going to be complex adults. No. And they're going to be better consumers of the healthcare system, because from the start, they and their parents are learning how you engage differently with the healthcare system. We also have the psychopharmacology project. I know we came, I think it was last session, we came with a proposal to go at risk for the psychoactive drugs. We didn't get there. We do have a commitment that we believe next session you'll see that bill and a demonstration project will come out of it. We have every hope.
Boy.
We've spent a lot of time with Senator Winters to get there.
That's the answer.
So legislation in 2013...
I meant 2014.
Yeah, you're hoping legislation in 2014, although you did get the data. We passed something in 2012 to require that data to be made available.
And we get the data, and we get all the data that we need. The unfortunate problem is, because it comes down in a different stream, it's never going to mesh with our real-time system. So while we get the data and we can see it, it's not as actionable as we'd hoped.
Too bad that you just missed Burns, who left.
Oh, man.
You made that point earlier.
Well, we get it, but it's hard for it to be actionable, and as much work as Pacific Source has put into it and the health authority, there's just no way to change that. Until we actually have the spend, there's no way to change it. But we also want to talk about our emergency department project. And, you know, in the first year that we did this, we saw a 65% reduction in visits in the people that we served. We looked at one population of 144 individuals very intensively, and then took the learnings we got from that and translated it out to the rest of the community. With those 144 people, what we saw was a 71% cost avoidance in the hospital costs alone. We don't call that savings in a hospital, because you still have, you know, you have to keep the doors open and the lights on, and 144 people aren't going to change that. But they are going to change throughput, ED wait times, provider satisfaction. The people that I see all the time, if I'm not seeing them all the time, that's going to make me more satisfied, because I feel like I'm accomplishing something more. And what this did for our community was, basically, we put in $313,000. That's what our community put in. And we got a $356,000 return. That's not big money. But remember, that was only 144 people. And the delta in there that was the return came back to the Health Council and helped fund the next set of initiatives going forward. We still do this as the cost of doing business. St. Charles took this on, funds the community health workers, and funds the behavioral health consultants and other folks who make this project run. We need to do some fine-tuning with it. Especially in terms of data, to be able to get more data. But there are probably close to 1,000 people that we touch in this project right now. So it's a pretty cool type of a project that I think has been
a good
success.
So the 144 people are managed by a community health worker. I mean, each one of these is an individual case that you're managing in order to, quote, avoid having to go to the emergency room. Is that how this works?
Not exactly. What we found is, sometimes it's the community health worker because you're dealing in the social disparities of health. Sometimes it's a behavioral health consultant because you're dealing with folks who may have significant mental health challenges that aren't interfacing well with the mental health system. Sometimes it's the primary care physician because you have folks with complex medical problems who come in time and time and time again. And sometimes it's the nurse care coordinator. So it's really that team-based approach. We learn very quickly that it's not fits-all.
Sure.
It's not just community health workers. Probably only 60% of our people have ever touched a community health worker.
If I may, I think that also we can look at the dollars, but if we remember the triple aim, we're trying to go for better access and better health as well. This gets to a better quality of life. Of these individuals, that cohort was no less than 19, but as many as 62 times to the trips to the emergency room in a 12-month period. We found that a lot were veterans. Mm-hmm. We found So we're also looking at a pilot project. I'm even fearful to say it. Oh my gosh.
Say it.
So, because imagine if we can house our veterans, and if we could look at this population, is there maybe something that we could be doing that would spend, take some of the CCO dollars, wrap around services, get them housed, get them upright, essentially. It's going to be difficult to meet your mental health or your physical health needs if you don't have a place to live. And so how can we better serve and get better access to that population so that it isn't just about the dollars, it's about truly returning them back to our community in a more logical fashion.
And one of the things we learned early on this year, we saw a spike in our ER in the first quarter of the year. Started in December, and it kind of went through February, a little bit into March. I haven't seen April and May's totals yet to see where we're at. And we went, well, why are we seeing the spike in our ER? Well, it was kids under the age of 18 during RSV season. And RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, happens every year in Central Oregon. We know this. It happens all over the state. But starting to look at that data differently, this project has never included pediatrics. One of our new initiatives will include pediatrics in that project. But how do we forecast how we change our behavior then next year? We went into our strategic initiative project because we wanted to do new initiatives. And we went into this process about a year ago where we looked at 38 different options of what were we going to go after next and how were we going to do that. What we came out with were 8 primary initiatives, 6 of which I'll show you here in just a second, that we approved to go forward. But what's interesting is how we funded them. We needed about $500,000 to do what we wanted to do. And Pacific Source said, you know, we've invested a lot in here and we're not the capitalizing entity for all of these things. How are we going to do this? So our community on the Health Council said, well, we're going to tax ourselves. And they imposed a 0.58% tax on the per member per month allotment that they got for the year prior. And that number got us to $500,000. And it was everybody in. You know, the hospital wrote a check for about $200,000, a little bit more than that. The IPA wrote a check, and initially the IPA said, we're not sure that we can do this. So the hospital and the dental care organization said, we'll cover you until you can. And they did. And now the IPA has been able to make good on their investment. The dental care organization, they're not even fully into the CCO at this point, put in nearly $50,000. We like to say, you know, Mike Shurtcliffe puts his money where his mouth is. And he committed to initiatives that aren't always just supporting dental. The counties put in nearly $80,000 to support these initiatives. And the point being, everybody's got cash in this barrel on the idea that these initiatives are going to really help to transform our community. The initiatives had to be based in the transformation plan elements. And you know that there's 8 of them. I won't bore you with the CCO lecture. But in Central Oregon, because we're Central Oregon, we had an extra one. We added the primary care public health partnership because we felt that that relationship between primary care and public health was so important we wanted to be held accountable for it. So we actually have 9 transformation plan elements. I know, we're overachievers. And they also had to address the quality incentive metrics. And this isn't meant to be something that you can see and understand and read. But what I wanted to show you was these are partnerships between the hospital and primary care and the CCO that pull together how are we going to impact these measurements and who are the providers that we're going to pull onto our team so that we can have a mini work group that's going to pull each one of these 17 metrics together. And you see a lot of the same names up there because some of us work in the same places. I'm from the hospital and Jade's from Mosaic Medical and Wade's from the pediatrics clinic and Damien's from Webco. But the idea is we divided between the community health partnerships and the CCO provider to come up with a work group of how we're going to attack these. We also needed to have our essential elements of a global budget, advanced payment methodology, data analytics and evaluation, and workforce development, along with the health information exchange, which we all believe is the unicorn that someday we'll get to see. But the idea was, and I'll go through this very quickly, that we could get to the point where we change how we're being paid, so we're paying for outcomes, the ideal of what you want, and how we can really start to look at what we're doing. Because we recognize that hospitals need to become cost centers, not profit centers within a community. We also realize, that insurers need to become facilitators of care rather than barriers to care, and that our goal is to eventually get ourselves to a value-based payment system. That's what we're hoping to get through these initiatives and through our transformation elements. Oh, whoops, I backed up that. You want to talk a little bit about the evaluation component that we've...
Sure. I think another interesting piece of this work is how many people are interested in this work.
Oh, yeah.
And wanting to do research on the work that has been presented. So we have started a partnership with OHSU and are looking to do a research, more of a academic research evaluation of the work that we're doing. And so we will be working closely with individuals who will be taking on doing that research for some of our initiatives, primarily through it. What they'll do is come in and say, we'd like, it has to be work that we are currently doing, not wanting to take on a variety of other pieces, and then being able to work with us very closely in utilizing our data, but then also being able to have that be a way for us to know that what we're doing is actually working or not.
Who are you working with at OHSU?
Jackie Shannon has been our primary contact. but Dan Dorsa came down a few weeks ago and toured the community for a while. I would be surprised if a week has gone by this year that we haven't been hit for an evaluation or a grant request or a letter of support.
Yeah, you might want to coordinate that at OHSU.
We're trying, that was the idea. That's the idea that we're trying to get to. It's about bringing the resources to the table to do it. We had hopes that there might be some resources through the Transformation Center that would help us do that at the local level, but those resources aren't designed for this purpose, so we've got to figure out, short of funding it ourselves, how are we going to do that? It's hard to say no to a researcher who's got a great idea, but sometimes we have to because it's just overwhelming.
It's all the time.
So all the data is gathered and housed in one place so you can manipulate it, analyze that, or is it still, it's been drawn from different places when you're doing
it? It's all over.
Okay.
It's all over. We don't have, even if you look at the all-payer, all-claims database, that's great, but it doesn't capture what we call churn, which is when people fall off of the plan. The only place you can really capture churn is to go back to the actual occurrences that occur within a hospital with uninsured folks and in a primary care clinic with uninsured folks. And then you can get the encounters, but how you feed that in becomes very difficult and challenging.
Sure.
We're trying hard, but we're not quite there yet. This is a slide that just shows you what our initiatives are right now, and the two that are grayed out are initiatives that we approved, but they're not ready for prime time. The rest of the initiatives are ones that we're actively working on right now, and I can dig into any one of these if you'd like. I'll just show you one in particular, but I'm happy to dig into anything that you're interested in. We've had a fairly extensive behavioral health and primary care integration project that has expanded, you know, that we've put psychologists into primary care clinics. We did this, started doing this about 3 years ago. It was one of our initial projects, and it was wildly successful. We saw great provider satisfaction. It tagged nicely with the ED project. We saw great things going on with that, and we sought to expand it this year to include pediatrics, obstetrics, and also internal medicine.
Robin, let's plan on going for another 15 minutes. Huh?
Okay, you got it. We wanted to look at the type of consistent metrics for outcomes because we know that we can anecdotally talk about what we're doing well, but unless we're consistently all measuring the same metrics, it doesn't mean anything. So what we've done is set up, I'm going to go up one slide here and I'll come back to that one. We've got a proposal for a global budget project with St. Charles, where all of the patients who are in the St. Charles Family Care Clinics, and that's about 5,000-6,000 patients, will move into a global budget where we'll also pay for the behavioral health integration and primary care on a global budget fashion. This does a couple different things. One, it allows us to set up a comparison project with a group out of Colorado. And Colorado has, I don't know if you're familiar with the RCCO model that they have in Colorado, where they've had a voluntary kind of a CCO type replication that they're doing over there called RCCOs. They're also doing a similar primary care and behavioral health project that they approached us with to see if they could study ours and replicate that study so that we have a bi-state replication going on. But we also want to look at
does how we pay for care change how care is provided? We believe that to be true, but to actually have a study that's looking at that, the University of Colorado researchers are really interested in that. We're also looking at, in this model in our region, deploying what's called healthy lives. And earlier this year, when you had your bill, Representative Conger, about looking at how you incentivize Medicaid populations, we presented on the Healthy Lives product. We're actually going to demonstrate that, I believe, starting in September with our Medicaid population in Central Oregon to see if incentives and engagement strategies with the Medicaid population changes the experience of care. And we can do that because not all of the clinics in Central Oregon will be deploying that. So we'll have our own natural control group. And we're hoping that we can start to show within a year or two that incentivizing care differently in an engagement strategy can help to change patient accountability. That's something we've struggled with a lot in our region. I can tell you when you go out and talk in a community forum in Central Oregon, and I'm sure it happens everywhere else, but one of the issues that will come up predictably is patient accountability. And most time folks go to talking about a stick as opposed to talking about a carrot. And we want to see if we can't get there with some carrots in our region. We know that that's legal and within the bounds of the law to do, so we're going to study it.
So when you say a year or two, so you determined that, let's say, 2 years is that in fact in 2 years the behavior has changed and that it's a permanent, that's what it'll be? I mean, how do we decide the year or two? What is that?
Part of that I leave to the research minds to tell us, is it 1 year or is it 2 year? Part of that also is due to contract terms, and I don't know what the contract term is yet. But the idea with any of the initiatives that we've done, we put $500,000 in funding in this year with the idea that next year we would be able to change the practices that we're doing so that we can then change the contracts. For instance, we have an initiative related to chronic pain, and we're trying two different types of chronic pain programs, neither of which are covered under the Oregon Health Plan. But for this year, they're either funded by the Health Council or funded by changing how Pacific Source pays the providers. At the end of the year, if we're able to prove that they're working, we'll change it. Does that make sense?
Sure.
That's how we've approached everything we've done in our initiatives. Little tests of change. This is Institute for Healthcare Improvement 101. Little tests of change to see if we can make an impact in a population, and if so, then we'll expand it. And that's been the mantra of this group since we started. We've had a lot of crazy ideas that have actually worked out really well for us. And the ED project is not the least of those. But the idea is that we want to be able to really shift how we're dealing with primary care and get ourselves to where we're talking about health behaviors and focusing on not only what is your issue that's bringing you in today, but what's going on in the rest of your world. Because we know, and you've heard it a million times, what happens in the medical system is 10% of your health care. It's the other 90% that matters. And changing that dynamic in primary care has been a really big job and something that the region's very much committed to. I want to leave us enough time, so I'm going to, you have these in the packet to look at the initiatives that we're doing, and if you have questions, please let me know. They're very interesting initiatives, and we hope to be able to come back to you 2 years from now and tell you that we've knocked it out of the park on all of them.
I think part of the interesting piece that isn't on the slides, but the amount of work and the process that you went through to get to those initiatives involved a lot of work, primarily at the operations council level.
Oh, yeah.
With, you know, just brainstorming what could we do, you know, where are places where we can get a good return on investment for this money, and painstakingly plotting out ideas, looking at how much they cost, looking at sources of funds, looking at what providers would have to be involved to actually execute the initiative, et cetera, et cetera. It was a really detailed, thorough process, and I think the result will be that these initiatives are starting out from a much stronger position in terms of both a clinical justification and a financial justification. It's really, it was really impressive.
Thank you. Thank you. If you go onto our website, you can see the two-page papers that each successful initiative was required to present. We had, like, I want to say 12 initiatives presented, 8 were selected. And those papers are out there that lay out, here's your outcomes. Every initiative has a contract, whether we funded it with funds or not, that says these are the metrics I'm accountable for. And they can't just be fiscal. They have to be
What are you doing clinically? What is going to bring value to the consumers that we're serving? Where's your patient engagement portion? And then the fiscal, of course. We want to spend the last little bit of time we have talking to you about what we see as the future of community governance. This has been a great project. I've had the pleasure of being the executive director now for the last 3 years. Started out as a loaned executive, went on to a regular contract, and my time as executive director is actually coming up at the end of this month. So this will be the last time that I visit with you as the executive director of the Health Council. And the Health Council will be moving on under the guidance for a while of our in-house council representative, Conger.
Uh-oh. Very thought.
But the benefits of this, in terms of transparency and accountability, are absolutely immeasurable. I know, Representative Greenlick, that you tried very hard to bring forward some transparency bills this year. And
got a little.
You got a little. It's scary. The conversations we had around this with the joint management agreement development were scary. But once people got comfortable with it, I mean, realized for the first 2 years, we were public meetings, and no one ever showed up. And then all of a sudden they put a label on it that said you're now a coordinated care organization and everybody's interested and they come, and that's a little intimidating. And it's been okay. No one has died. There has been no bloodshed. Mm-hmm. In public.
And you've actually announced who the members of your community advisory council are?
We do. They're on our website.
Oh, boy.
We don't identify whether they're consumers or citizen members. They're just members.
Just members.
Mm-hmm. Not all do that.
Now, understand that our community advisory council meetings this time are not public, but it's not because there's anything to hide, but it's because we have problems with room space. It's hard for us to find venues where we can hold public meetings in our region because we move them around. You know, 1 month it's in Prineville, and the next month you're in Madras, and then you might be in La Pine.
Prineville having less Schwabs.
I've thought of that.
They have a wonderful OSU campus there.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, and if you haven't heard, we're building a new hospital campus out there, going from a 24-bed critical access hospital to a 12-bed hospital, because that's the right size for that community. Yeah. And it's a very interesting process. The power of the community to change population health is our biggest strength and our biggest asset. Helping to figure out how we engage people in their care is a great benefit, and it's also one of our biggest challenges. We have not cracked that nut. We've not figured it out. We figured it out on a person-to-person-to-person basis, and it may take us touching every person to get there. I'm hoping we can find a faster way, but there you go. But at the end of the day, the collaboration in our community has helped to float everybody's boat. Mm-hmm. We've been able to keep everybody whole. We have very frank conversations, especially around House Bill 3309, about the reality that the health system needs time to transform and how to change their payer system so that they don't go broke. We are a large part of the economy in that community. St. Charles is the largest employer. Changing the ship of how we're paid is a process and not an event. And it's a difficult process. And we've had very frank conversations about that. I'm going to let you talk about the challenges.
Well, I want to start by saying that I'm really proud of our group, because it has not been as easy as it may sound. But I think the fact that we do not have one voice that is more vocal than another and can outvote another, I think really keeps this working. I think that we have the appropriate balance between people involved across all venues that are necessary for transformation. But this trust piece that's noted on the slide, I think, is critical. We have to trust one another as we move forward. And I've watched the legislature have to go through trying to legislate good behavior. And I don't think that we can write trust into a bill. I don't think we can write collaboration into a bill. But I think we can write some of the components that make the playing field level into a bill. And I think that is what we've been able to carve out in our community. In our community is a foundation that is transparent, that breeds collaboration, and also makes sure that someone doesn't have a disadvantage or an unfair advantage over another. So the challenges would be communication. As I mentioned early on, we need to really make sure that we have good communication between the state of Oregon, because we are set up differently. And we need to make sure that we're clear on our role and function to all of our committees in moving forward. But then also the public engagement. people want to know, what is a CCO? What does this mean? There's a lot of publicity around CCOs, but not a lot of interaction with just your everyday folk on the street. So I think we have a lot of work in front of us, but this foundation and this platform seems to be working in our region.
Well, thank you guys very much. And I'm sorry you're going to have such a degradation in your management structure.
Well,
in a big way. In a big way.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
You guys have done a great job.
Dr. Henderson has been amazing. Just the guiding force that we would not be where we are if it had not been for her leadership and ability to know where the landmines are, how to stay away, but point them out, admire them, and move on.
And provide therapy and all the while.
Absolutely. She's amazing.
You are too kind.
No, she'll be missed.
Well, and we would not be where we are if we didn't have Chair Bainey.
Oh, you're...
She has been, I kid you not, there's nothing like seeing a tense situation and watching this woman come in there and masterfully, time and time again, masterfully make everybody feel heard, everybody feel present, everybody feel welcomed, and a few times feel slapped. But there's nothing like being slapped so delicately and so carefully that you go, thank you, ma'am. Thank you. May I have another?
Well, it's a team effort. Team effort.
Representative Lively?
So I just wanted to follow up a little bit on the transparency that you talked about that, and you mentioned right at the end kind of the engaging of the whole community and them understanding really what's going on. So what's been, if indeed your meetings have been open, you've had these kind of frank conversations, so what's been the role of the media? I mean, how have they treated that or responded to it? I mean, have they reported it? Have they ignored it?
Yes, and they're welcome, and they attend a fair amount of our meetings. They're always welcome. I think it's educating the media, as a commissioner, can't always read or believe what you read, and so it's making sure that the information that's out and is actually accurate. Mm-hmm. But I think we've had great involvement, and they've been trying to stay ahead of it. It's been changing, as we all know. I think once the legislative session is over, then I think we'll have some more community outreach. But I mean, just as in terms of your taxpayers,
right?
What's the transformation? What are we working toward? What does this look like? And so our community advisory council will be doing some community forums, and I think those are really critical. Funding those, making sure there's good attendance and you have good outreach.
But I get the question, and I appreciate that. I was just trying to understand, is sometimes the taxpayers, and a lot of the information they get is from the media, so whatever they read. And so I'm just trying to understand, has that, to date anyway, has what they've been providing that based on your meetings, conversations, helped the taxpayers and people understand, or is it?
I think they have.
I think so. Yeah. It was interesting to work with Richard Coe, who's the editor of the Bulletin, who's had us in there a couple of times. And when your transparency bills were coming forward, Representative, it was so hard because he's sitting here saying, well,
you're just doing it.
Can you see this? Can you see this? I'm like, you can see it all. You can come to the meeting. Here's the minutes. Here's everything. And he's like, ended up writing an editorial that basically said, we want the rest of the state to do what we do.
That's great.
And what we do already. And they've been very supportive. They've been very, they've pushed back and asked hard questions. But I think the coverage that we've gotten has been pretty fair, primarily because we're very open. One of the reporters came to our last health council meeting. He stayed the whole time. And he had been gone for a year on sabbatical. And so he came back. This was his first meeting in there. And I said, you do realize you've just done something that no other reporter in Oregon has ever done. You sat through an entire governance meeting for a health, for basically CCO governance meeting. No other reporter in Oregon has done this. He was floored. So it's been a very unique opportunity for us.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest. Thank you for having us.
I will close the information meeting, and we are adjourned sine die.